Get ready to listen, learn, and earn CE hours. This podcast features content from an accredited CE activity provided by Calibri Healthcare. Visit elitelearning.com/podcasts for accreditation and disclosure statements and instructions on how you may be able to earn CE credits.
Welcome back for Post-Traumatic Stress in Healthcare Workers. I am Maria Morales with Calibri Healthcare. And back with me is Dr. Daphne Essex. We are going to continue the conversation about the influence of the COVID-19 pandemic. We will also talk about contributing factors, interventions, and strategies for how the healthcare team can facilitate conversation about this topic and possibly work together to address it. So let's talk about some of the things we can do about post-traumatic stress. So Dr. Essex, do you have any stories you would be able to share about some of the experiences of healthcare workers and maybe the additional stress or emotional toll of caring for patients or clients during the pandemic?
So on a personal note, caring for clients during the pandemic was highly stressful. I was working with a younger, healthy adult population. The attempt to strategize preventive processes, prevent cross-contamination, manage those who were positive in isolation, those who were quarantined as a result of being a close contact, having to make those daily calls to ensure they were physically and mentally okay during the entire process was very demanding and stressful. Knowing that individuals were in isolation or quarantine for 10 to 14 days or longer, depending on the symptoms. I was the subject matter expert for the mission. I lost sleep, worked considerable long hours, worried about the safety and the health of others, trying to assure no one else declined under my surveillance. I had over approximately 200 clients rotating in and out every couple of weeks. I was literally traumatized and felt ill mentally as well as physically. I was asked to return to assist with the mission again the next year. And I remember tears coming to my eyes for just being asked. I asked myself, how did I survive? I recall feeling ill because I was so tired mentally and physically. I remember when the mission was over, I literally could not move. It was this like a temporary conversion issue. My stress was affecting my family members. The talk about an experience. I dealt with supposedly healthy individuals. However, having to deal with their fears, my fears, and trying to educate myself and those around me, the anxiety was high. And we know too much anxiety can cause mental distortion. On another note, I had an interview with an OBGYN provider who provided care and reported the stressors of having pregnant women on ventilators and working long hours to ensure the safety of the mother and baby. Having to limit exposure and keeping conversations to a minimum were stressful. The constant calls that she remembered, the postponed surgeries, caused surgical cases to be backlogged. The provider was fortunate to not have any loss of any clients. However, the provider did work with a diverse population group and feared for her safety with having to go back and forth between healthcare settings. She reported having trouble sleeping, having anxiety to this day. So again, not only is there management of work issues, there are those personal and family issues that have to be managed as well.
Well, I'm sorry, Dr. Essex. I mean, that's a lot. My heart goes out to you. I want to thank you for your dedication. And I would imagine there are so many healthcare workers listening who empathize and understand in some way with what you've described in your personal experience and what you described from this other provider's experience. There were so many additional responsibilities outside of the usual when it comes to the pandemic, and that is a lot. It's a lot of weight to carry. Do you think healthcare in general is just an environment where healthcare workers are at increased risk for this kind of stress anyway?
From research, we can see that healthcare workers are at risk for PTSD. However, some symptoms are presumed mild or the resilience factor is high. Routine day-to-day operations with a few bad days are considered normal and tolerable experiences. However, there are workers who may work in the ICU or ER or hospital setting for a brief period and realize the hospital setting or that specific specialty area was not for them because of different internal or external reasons. For whatever the reason may be, it might not have been reported. So do we really know if it was because of a previous traumatic experience or the stressor of the job? In some cases, I'm sure we could say both.
You mentioned the word resilience. Personally, I find resilience a fascinating topic. Thresholds for when a stressful or traumatic event crosses that line from stressful to traumatizing, from something we can cope with to something that exhausts our coping mechanisms, from an unpleasant experience to a truly majorly life-changing experience. It depends on so many factors. How do you describe resilience?
So resilience is important, but it's how you overcome an obstacle or situation in a positive way. It's a bounce back to normal or even more greatness. So resilience reveals your courage, your strength, and abilities to continue to move forward.
That's good. What are some more examples of the way COVID-19 seemed to increase psychological distress for healthcare teams and teammates?
So associated occupational stressors from the pandemic have presented some major issues. The healthcare workers pose a risk to clients when they are mentally distressed. Possibilities are medication errors, lower standard of care, compassion fatigue. There could be decreased productivity and an overall lower quality of care. It has been indicated that from 21 to 94% of hospital personnel with PTSD have comorbid depression, which might have preceded the PTSD. Sometimes comorbid conditions may worsen the PTSD symptoms.
Wow, everything is so connected. Anything else you would like to share with us about the impact of COVID-19?
There was one study that resulted how healthcare workers who were infected with COVID-19 and recovered, they had a higher rate of psychological symptoms versus those who were not infected. So this was related to the fear of reinfection. So would there be survival the next time I get infected, infection of the family, being isolated? These findings revealed that the healthcare workers had more depression, anxiety, stress, avoidance, and those PTSD symptoms. We also know there are cases of what we call long haul symptoms related to having had COVID. Long haulers can have both physical and mental challenges related to having had COVID-19.
What you're saying reminds me of the resilience discussion earlier, and something else too. Once we have experienced something, sometimes it's easier to believe it can happen again versus someone who maybe has never gone through something before. Sometimes realizing a negative experience could be repeated can cross the line from just knowing about something to actual like fear, worry, and anxiety that it could happen again. Do you think that's a fair statement?
I would have to agree. In addition, if the individual is not effectively coping with the fears, worry, or anxiety, this would lead them to being diagnosed with a disorder, which could become a chronic condition that will require ongoing interventions and treatment.
I see. How practical are resources for healthcare workers? I was a physician, a psychologist, and a nurse who were discussing the topic of this podcast, and the topic of resources came up. Some organizations might have better resources for staff than others, of course. And sometimes it seems like there's signs displayed where healthcare workers work, you know, maybe break rooms or public areas to help increase awareness about stress and wellness. Sometimes there's pamphlets that are provided. If a healthcare worker just sees flyers or pamphlets, what would be a good next step to seek for more information?
The worker would need to look into the support the organization is offering. Hopefully, the larger organizations have already implemented a process to prevent or assist the healthcare worker to return to normalcy. Some of the smaller organizations might not have a process, but should have co-joined with some of the larger organizations to aid in treatment for their staff. Otherwise, there are 1-800 numbers to call, such as the National Alliance on Mental Illness, which is also called NAMI, or at 1-800-950-NAMI, N-A-M-I, or 1-800-950-6264, to have available resources. There's also the Suicide Crisis Hotline at 1-800-273-TALK or 1-800-273-8255. There is also a 3-digit number that can connect an individual to the Lifeline by dialing just 988. And there are several reading materials and therapeutic podcasts or media sessions that individuals could listen to or read based on performances as well. There's also online resource support available.
What about other people resources? It seems sometimes that healthcare workers may not use people resources that are available to them, like chaplains, therapists, counselors. Many organizations or hospitals have some kind of a employee assistance program or employee assistance benefit through their employers. Do you recommend these sources of help early on?
So any type of support that's considered positive would be a great help. What we do know is early intervention is the key to prevention. I would definitely say that healthcare administrators and the healthcare workers share responsibility and development of a program that could best support workers during crises such as the COVID-19 pandemic. The program should be available or operational to assist those healthcare workers who may have encountered psychological stress from day-to-day operation as a worker. There will always be some type of traumatic event periodically, such as death, while working in healthcare. However, the magnitude may not be as great as it was with the pandemic. So as we move forward, any day-to-day routine traumatic event might be a PTSD trigger that may cause the healthcare worker to spiral down quicker than usual. Therefore, organizations should be moving quickly to have supportive services implemented or be in the process of being operational to handle these type of situations.
In your opinion, do you think these services and people which are willing to help are underused?
Certainly, I do. We know that there are adequate personnel and staff to develop a crisis intervention team or behavior health team to support their own or neighbor employees, such as your psychiatrist, psychologists, social workers, chaplains, behavior specialists, counselors. There are many approaches that a team could work together to form that cohesiveness to improve or to increase or improve resilience in the healthcare worker. In order for an organization to be a success, it will need a large percentage, if not all of the staff, to be on the end of the continuum called mental wellness.
That is interesting. Let's shift right now and talk about contributing factors. Can you describe for us some more that may contribute to post-traumatic stress?
I would have to say, in addition to the burnout and stress, more injury related to a feeling of guilt based on decisions that had to be made to sustain life, the healthcare workers' inability to respond adequately and the violation of the healthcare workers' values. Another mental health challenge would be compassion fatigue, in which the healthcare worker is too tired to care or have the usual compassion due to mental and physical exhaustion. So this can cause one to feel overwhelmed, which in turn can lead to major depressive episodes and anxiety. So both of these disorders fall under PTSD. It has been determined that older adults have been found to have better mental health coping strategies than younger adults. This may be a result of their learned abilities to cope or adapt to life-changing events from a professional and psychological standpoint. The lack of PPE was a major concern during the COVID-19 pandemic. Factories had to close down, and this seriously slowed production, and resources became scarce. So burnout increased among our healthcare workers. One study indicated stress levels started to decrease when PPE resources increased. So the burnout risk factor was a result of physical and mental exhaustion. So this was definitely a major concern that would require organizational support, because there's a higher probability of a decrease in quality of care, as well as opportunities for the worker to make detrimental errors or mistakes under these type circumstances. The long work hours, working short staff, and not having enough PPE were definitely stress-inducing concerns. There were issues with ethical dilemma, which is the more injury, and compassion fatigue that we talked about already. There was one meta-analysis study that indicated socio-demographic risk factors, such as being a female and young in age, having that prior mental illness, such as depression and anxiety, mood disorder, and lack of or not enough social support. Also included worry, burnout, which has been previously mentioned, the interpersonal problems, and the individual's belief system.
If those factors you mentioned can increase risk, are there any characteristics that are more protective in nature to help a person lessen their risk for post-traumatic stress?
Again, being married with that good support system, or just having a good support system regardless of marital status, helps. Having seniority, whether it's career or age in the organization, having that resilience and a history of having effective ways to cope with issues or crisis. These are factors that can help a person. Having that organization support is also a great protective factor.
Let's shift the discussion to interventions. So we know the power of evidence-based practice. Please tell us some of what the evidence and research says about non-pharmacological interventions.
I will briefly talk about a few of the non-pharmacological interventions that can be used to minimize trauma. Non-invasive treatment is almost always considered the preferred treatment. Evidence-based treatment programs that have shown therapeutic promise are your cognitive processing therapy, which is CPT, your prolonged exposure therapy, cognitive therapy for PTSD. You have your eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing. Then you have your therapy pets and your family support.
I would think therapy pets and family support would be really well known or more familiar. But can you tell us briefly or give us a light overview about some of the others you mentioned?
So your cognitive processing therapy, clients are good at self-blaming. So thinking if you had only done this differently, that person would still be alive. So CPT assists with altering the mind to accommodate new belief or way of thinking. CPT is a trauma-focused psychotherapy protocol, and it's the most frequently researched therapy. It has been shown to be effective in complex PTSD cases and has been highly recommended for use in clinical practice. You have your prolonged exposure, which is based on emotional response related to the fear. It encourages the individual to talk about the fear situation or place that has been avoided in the past that caused the distress. This is done like in real time or using an imaginary approach. The goal of PE is to distort erroneous information and help the individual confront the fear. You have cognitive therapy for PTSD. Now, this therapy includes CPT and your PE, which is your prolonged exposure, which is based on cognition and behaviors. So the goals are to modify the negative behaviors and thinking and the trauma memory and remove the problematic behavior and the thinking. So then you have your eye movement and reprocessing therapy. So the patient therapeutic engagement may include a short image exposure of the incident using the imagination with back and forth eye movements for processing the traumatic event, or there can be use of hand taps with the use of a STEM machine. So the bilateral stimulation keeps the left hemisphere of the brain engaged while processing the emotional memory that is stuck over in the right hemisphere of the brain. So the goal is for self-mastery of the experience, processing the memories and triggers, and teaching the client appropriate social interaction skills. So you want these clients to be able to respond appropriately to situations that are triggers and to effectively adapt to the challenging situations.
That's interesting. I think I'd like to read more about that. When would you recommend someone take advantage of some of the non-pharmacological interventions? I'm going to assume earlier is better than later, as you mentioned previously.
Yes, wellness recovery interventions should be started sooner than later. Early identification and intervention usually promotes a better outcome for the individual.
Why don't we talk about screening? What kind of screening tools are available for post-traumatic stress or PTSD?
So there are several screening tools that's available. Screening tools provide opportunities for clinicians to develop a picture of clients to adequately diagnose and determine the treatment options. These tools are also available online and can be self-administered. Utilizing different screening tools by different clinicians could sometimes lead to bias with diagnosis, because the client experience may or may not fit into one screening category. However, the purpose of the assessment is to assist with symptom recognition, frequency, your time frame, and the severity of the issue. So treatment is based on symptom assessment and the presentation of the client. There are a list of diverse screening questionnaires for mental health assessment that may include, but they're not limited to some of the ones that I will mention. One of the most common ones that's used is your patient health questionnaire, which we call the PHQ-9, which measures depressive symptoms over the past 2 weeks on a scale of 0, which is not at all having issues, 2, 3, which is you're having the issues nearly every day. Then you have your PTSD checklist for the DSM, which is your PCL-5, which is rated on a scale of 0 to 4. So the PCL evaluates the severity of the symptoms using like a 20-item self-report of the issue. You have the trauma history questionnaire, which is the THQ. This is a 21-item to self-report measures to evaluate trauma over a lifetime or when the event occurred. you have post-traumatic cognition inventory, which measures thoughts and beliefs about self and others. Post-exposures, there's a 33-item self-report scale for this one with a rating of 1 to 7, in which you can totally agree or you can totally disagree. You also have the alcohol use disorder identification test. You might have heard the word audit C, which is a 3-item version of the full audit 10-item screening to identify those with excessive alcohol use. There's the drug abuse screening test, the DAS, which identifies non-specific use of drugs. And also there's that adaptation of the Michigan alcohol screening test, which is called the MAS screening tool, which also measures the severity of alcohol use. We use the CAGE questionnaire, which is a brief screen to detect alcohol use. And also you have the Columbia suicide severity rating scale, which measures suicidal ideations and those suicidal behaviors among individuals.
That was a lot of information. Thank you for putting that together for us. So since we've discussed non-pharmacological interventions and screening, let's move over to pharmacological interventions.
Sometimes non-pharmacological interventions are not as effective as we want them to be as the sole therapy. In addition, depending on the therapeutic intervention being used, therapy may take weeks, months, or even years. So as the healthcare worker continues with non-pharmacological interventions, there may be a need for sooner relief to help target some of those symptoms. This is when a pharmacological intervention can be beneficial. Keep in mind that pharmacological interventions could be an initial choice as well, and can be the sole therapeutic intervention for the moment. There are several pharmacological medications that can be used for treatment. I will list some name variations with some of these medications. With that being said, please keep in mind that pharmacological medications are not for prophylactic use of trauma or disasters. So we have the selective serotonin inhibitors, such as your fluoxetine, your citalopram, your paroxetine, your fluvoxamine, and your sertraline, which can be your first line medication treatment for PTSD. Now, these medications have a pretty good safety and side effect profile. If your desired outcomes are not met with one of these SSRIs medications, there's still some of your second and third generation medications, such as your tricyclic antidepressants, such as your tofranil or your Elavil, amitriptyline, your anafrenil. Some of them you know by trade names or their generic names. You have your monoamine oxidase inhibitors, such as your Marplans, the Prineate or Nardia. However, some of the side effects are more greater with these medications. Suicidal precaution should be assessed in all clients starting any type of antidepressant, regardless of the class of the medication. There is another medication that has been studied and has been shown to reduce those PTSD symptoms, and it can be used as a monotherapy drug, and this is prazosin or minipress. It has been shown to reduce nightmares. It's a central acting antagonist blood pressure medication that is used to help with those PTSD symptoms. We also have your benzodiazepines, which are also helpful, but should be used as a short-term treatment and should not be a monotherapy drug. Example, this drug can be used with an SSRI until the efficacy of the drug starts to take effect, which is usually about 2 to 4 weeks.
Well, thank you so much for all of this great and very practical information. It really does help to put all the little pieces together about how treatments work for PTSD. If we notice a colleague who seems to be struggling with post-traumatic stress, or we notice that we need some help with coping through certain times in our lives, sometimes it's hard to know how to best start talking about it. So how would you recommend starting the conversation when we need to seek help for ourselves?
As healthcare workers, we often don't prioritize self-care. There's often fear of being stigmatized by others for providing self-care needs. However, there are some positives with self-care. Self-care is highly recommended as a way for individuals to cope and balance their physical and mental well-being. So often when one decides the importance of self-care, they will often seek out the help that they need.
Mm-hmm. Any strategies for facilitating respectful discussion with a coworker?
The initiator of that conversation should feel comfortable with the approach. There's a chance this is possible if they have a close working relationship and interact often with each other, both formally and informally. Otherwise, it should be reported to a supervisor or a manager to approach, since they interact with the coworker on a different level as it relates to incidents, counselings, and performance evaluations. So another good approach and strategy for the supervisor is to incorporate a screening tool to assess the staff at intervals, place pamphlets in break rooms, have a chaplain or counselor to give a brief at meetings, form a peer-to-peer support group, or form a buddy system for surveillance. There can also be use of all this digital technology for support and training that's available.
Are there any preferred words or language choices that are better when discussing PTS? How can we lessen stigma with our word choices and make sure that we're using respectful approaches in conversation?
One thing to do is learn to listen before speaking. For example, you should get a feel for a client and feel comfortable with your approach. Sometimes telling the person about an experience that you had could open the door to a conversation. There's no perfect way to answer this question. However, when asking questions, be sure to ask those open-ended questions that require the client to elaborate a little bit more. Try to avoid those closed-ended questions, such as that will give you a yes or no answer.
We are going to prepare to wrap up the podcast conversation. Healthcare workers can place the needs of others before themselves on many occasions in their quest to heal and to care. And it's important to remember that we must take care of ourselves so that we can continue to help others. Let's help increase awareness and make a difference for those who need some additional care so that they can also help us when or if it's our turn as well.
Before we wrap up the conversation, let's talk about a scenario to discuss on how the healthcare team members can each play a role in working together to help our own in this post-traumatic stress conversation.
Oh, so, I like that. Yes. Please do that.
Okay. So with this case study, we have Derek, who's a physical therapist assistant, presenting to the emergency department of the healthcare system who employed him with signs and symptoms of vomiting, low-grade fever, nausea, and having abdominal pain. He ended up having an emergency surgery where his appendix was removed, and he was admitted for antibiotics and further observations on the surgical floor. While completing rounds, the hospitalist was inquiring about Derek's pain level. Derek said he had some mild pain, 3 out of 10, but said it didn't bother him too much since he hasn't been sleeping well anyway since after a scary car accident 6 weeks ago that he fortunately walked away from without major physical trauma. The nurse had noted that Derek had become very agitated and hurried to change the channel when the scene of a bad accident was shown on the TV of a crime show he had been watching. So on the admission assessment, Derek has also noted to be having a drink every night to help him sleep. The nurse was concerned about the behavior and approached the hospitalist at the nursing station, saying that she thought Derek might be in an unhealthy, having an unhealthy pattern of drinking. So the hospitalist then shared that Derek had told him about his previous car accident. As they talked, they shared information from each of them regarding things Derek had shared separately to each of them. They began to discuss whether consulting with the psychologist on the staff might help Derek before he was discharged after his appendectomy. So the psychologist walked by the nurse's station and the hospitalist and the nurse began to talk to ask him about evaluating the patient. The psychologist described how PTSD can manifest after a traumatic event and how it was better to not delay seeking treatment. After the psychologist's consultation, the three team members were able to come up with a collaborative plan to provide patient education, initiate pharmacologic intervention to help some of Derek's current symptoms, and connect him to an outpatient therapy clinic for follow-up for his PTSD. So by communicating as a team, Derek was able to begin his journey of therapy and healing before he was discharged to home, instead of continuing to struggle months on his own. So in this scenario, you have Derek, the patient. You have the nurse and the hospitalist who were attentive to Derek, to what Derek had reported. He reported not sleeping well, the accident, and they reported what they saw of Derek to each other. So the objective findings, noticing the agitation in his demeanor, the change of the television when an accident was there. The team of professionals, which your nurse, your physician, your psychologist, collaborated to determine a treatment plan for Derek. So this is how collaboration works. And this is what is needed to provide an effective treatment plan for those individuals that are having these traumatic thoughts. So Derek's physical and his mental health needs were simultaneously addressed, which is a great intervention for the client.
Well, this has been an interesting conversation for sure. And now we are nearing the end of the podcast. I know this has really made me think about how many healthcare workers might be affected by post-traumatic stress or even PTSD. I see where more awareness and conversations may be needed to better support our healthcare workers. Thank you so much for joining us. Another sincere thank you to Dr. Daphne Essex. And this is Maria Morales for Calibri Healthcare.
This podcast featured content from an accredited CE activity provided by Calibri Healthcare. Visit elitelearning.com/podcasts for accreditation and disclosure statements and instructions on how you may be able to earn CE credits. Take your learning to the next level by subscribing to more podcasts on compelling healthcare topics.